all the previous cases that I've been involved with, where the situation is like this here, it's always been a recovery. It's never been a...
Please, God. Please,
a happy ending.
Bring her home.
You will start to question whether a memory is real or false only when that element of memory or that...
Why did his father leave him in a ditch in the middle of nowhere, then lie about it and disappear?
From eye scrapings and evasive nose probings to incisions in the skin, John of God has performed countless unlicensed surgical procedures, seemingly with no anesthesia, on enraptured followers.
Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. Thank you guys so much for listening, and guess what? The Patreon is finally live, and the first episode posted. I'm super excited about our first case there, and the secrets that you, loyal listeners, and I will keep. I mean, there's going to be a lot more than just an extra case, because we will have bonus content that is also interactive with you. Monthly live streams you can tune into and ask questions. And one thing I really want to do is create a monthly show where you guys can tell me your, oh shit, near miss stories with danger, a deceptive person, a group, etc. This Patreon is for us. So if you want to listen to extra content and support the show, you can search for Seven Deadly Sinners on Patreon or click on the link in the show notes. The first post is part one of a case I was going to cover in the more public sphere, but I think its home is Patreon, and you'll see why. I'm also super excited to connect with you all more on the interactive live streams, and I'm just excited all over the place. I'm excited to build the series of your oh shit stories. I'll be uploading a video of my own oh shit near miss stories this month, so you can get an idea of the vibe. But it is truly open for all your stories. I just love human stories, and I find that I learn so much from you guys. I'm just so interested to hear any and every tale you have, of even weird family shit. And you can remain anonymous. And my dad will hate me for saying this right now, but a good example of weird family shit, and I'll explain it in one of my videos, this is a true story, my great uncle faked his death and left his family to, well, go listen. It's pretty embarrassing. I mean, like family embarrassing, but... whatever, my family's not going to sign up for Patreon. Maybe they will. Who knows? Hopefully not. So go find Seven Deadly Sinners on Patreon. And I love you and thank you. Okay, now for the heartbreaking, no, truly gut-wrenching, part four and final episode on the scumbag Eli Stutzman. Up top, I want to state that so much of this research came from Greg Olson's book, Abandoned Prayers, which I will link in the show notes. He poured his heart and soul, years of research, hundreds of interviews to give us the most definitive look into this ultimate why did he do it case. I still don't know, and I don't think we ever will know why Eli Stutzman did what he did. But now for the story. Last episode, you'll remember that Eli Stutzman went on the run after being questioned by cops and confessing to a friend that he killed his roommate, Glenn Pritchard. In the first month of life on the run, he brought his son Danny along until he drove him to the home of Dean and Margie Barlow, where he signed over temporary custody paperwork in his absence while he, quote, tracked down the killer himself. Eli, free as a bird, went on living his life. I mean, what's one silly suspected murder under your belt? I mean, once you've abandoned your son, you can now live as you want. Just like slightly more under the radar. After a faked ID and social security card, Eli was back to his old tricks. He moved onto the ranch of a sexually confused rancher, Freeman, in the southern Colorado, northern New Mexico area, and worked for $5 an hour on the 600-acre ranch, painting, doing odd jobs, etc. And at night, he partied. And he partied hard. Months went by. In early fall, Dean Barlow, the man fostering Danny, came through town on his way to a convention. He dropped Danny off at the ranch with Eli, thinking it was time for him to be permanently with his father again. However, on his route back from New Mexico to Wyoming, Eli asked him to pick Danny back up, claiming his new roommate was an alcoholic and it wasn't a good place for Danny. Yet when Danny did spend time with his dad those few days on the ranch, some of the father and son activities included Danny taking photos of his dad's butt in skin-tight Levi's for his Seeking a Date ads. Dean, the obedient puppy dog, obliged and on his way back through town, picked Danny up and brought him back home to live with he and his wife. One could speculate, had Danny stayed, maybe Eli's life would have slowed down. But no. Eli just treated his little boy like a speed bump, kind of a in the way but tolerable, until he wasn't. But without Danny, Eli escalated like crazy. He was going out every night, hitting the Diamond Bell Saloon, any party he could get lost in a sea of men in, and any drug he could snort down. This is also the time when Eli was connected to two other murders. David Tyler, a man he met back in 1982, hooked up with, and likely did drugs with, who then emerged back into Eli's life. Tyler was a young man who was in Eli's orbit for years, even hanging out at his house for a brunch after an all-night party. Yet when David Tyler approached Eli's table at the Diamond Bell Saloon in the fall of 1985, while Eli was on the run for Glenn's murder, their relationship seemed more than fractured. According to Olson's book, quote, late one cold fall night, Kenny Hankins and Eli Stutzman were among a group partying at the Diamond Bell Saloon at the Strader Hotel in Durango. Stutzman bristled when David Tyler approached their table. Get the fuck out of here, Stutzman told Tyler, who immediately left for the hotel bathroom. Before Stutzman followed, he told Hankins, quote, if Tyler would pay me what he owes me, I'd never have to work again. Hankins didn't know what Stutzman was talking about, though he did think it might have something to do with drugs. And that was the last time he saw David again. End quote. November 10th, 1985. Within days of his encounter with Eli, David Tyler was found dead, bludgeoned to death. He was 36 years old. He was found in his truck bed outside his automatic transmission exchange, a body shop he co-owned. Then on December 5th, 1985, a friend of Tyler's named Dennis Slater was found shot to death in a basement storage room of the liquor store he worked. It's clear David Tyler and Eli knew each other, but unclear of Eli's association with Dennis Slater. But it's not hard to believe that Eli has been a suspect in these unsolved murders for decades. I'd like to tell you who these men were before moving on, because every human life deserves recognition. Well, except Eli. I'm joking, but not really. I can't stand him. According to several articles in which I've pieced together the more personal details about the two, Durango Herald being the main newspaper who wrote about them. Quote, David Tyler lived in Durango for 3 years. He was one of three owners of the automatic transmission exchange and worked as a manager and mechanic. He lived on 4th Avenue, wasn't married, and had no family in the area. Friends described Tyler as friendly, mellow, an occasional drug user, and a good mechanic. He liked to hang out at the Diamond Bell Saloon, but most of the time, he went home after work. I wish more was known about him, his personality, and life, but there's just not much to go on. But I'm sure he was much more dynamic than that. And then Dennis Slater. Well, he was 2 weeks away from earning a degree in industrial psychology from Fort Lewis College when he was shot to death, according to Herald Archives. He had worked at Junction Creek Liquors for about 6 months, usually 2 to 3 nights a week, a job, quote, he didn't need, according to his sister. He was tall, athletic, and had curly blondish hair, the sister told the Herald about a week after the shooting. She described him as a gentle giant, who even as a child wouldn't get into a fight with his brother and 6 sisters. He enjoyed the mountains, playing touch football, and was learning to telemark ski. The detectives on this case said they still think about both men, both still unsolved. If Eli Stutzman killed these two men, which I want to say he did, or at least had some involvement, but that's just my opinion. But if he did, Eli could be considered a spree killer more so than a serial killer. Or is he a serial killer? And then there's so many more murders we don't know about. It seems to be public consensus that he murdered his wife, Ida, and got away with it. Rest in peace, Ida. Poor sweet Ida. But that was years before. But then he murdered Glenn Pritchard in May of 1985. Then possibly David Tyler and Dennis Slater in the fall of 1985. And then, the most heartbreaking of all. On Christmas Eve, 1985, a man named Chuck Cleveland went out to get a haircut. But as a small town man might do, he stopped on his way to do a little pheasant hunting before. He drove through the small farm town that was no doubt hit by the farm crisis of the 80s, but Chuck did all right. He owned a small truck stop and he and his wife were comfortable. While driving and scouting the land, Chuck saw a color that didn't match up with the rest of the landscape. Blue fabric. He pulled over to investigate, and there, in a drainage ditch, he discovered the body of a frozen child in blue sleeper pajamas. He knew right away. He had seen dead bodies before from a previous job and from finding his mom passed away. The body of the child was discarded just 15 feet from the roadside and in below 30-degree weather, and was frozen. Heartbroken for the child, Chuck immediately phoned the police, and this is where Gary Young would take on the case of his life, one in which made him so emotional he wouldn't give up until that little boy had a name. But for now, the town called him Little Boy Blue. But who killed and just left this innocent child here? The town was reeling. All suspected it was a murder, but who amongst them could have done this? Or was it a person passing through? Regardless, the heartbreak of a little boy in blue sleeper pajamas lying in a ditch on Christmas Eve was more than this town could take. But it was also a boy they rallied to nurture and protect. In case you need a refresher, here's why Thrive Cosmetics is freaking amazing. Am I an overnight sensation? No, I'm not, but my skin is, thanks to Thrive's overnight sensation brightening sleep mask. I'm not joking. I wake up with a glow I can't even describe to you, but it's incredible. Thrive Cosmetics products are made with clean, high-performance, skin-loving ingredients. Their clinically proven formulas not only highlight your best features, they actually improve your skin over time. I can attest to that. All Thrive Cosmetics products are formulated without parabens, sulfates, and phthalates. Thrive Cosmetics never tests on animals. They're Leaping Bunny and PETA certified as 100% vegan and cruelty-free. Thrive Cosmetics has a bold mission that's truly bigger than beauty. For every product purchased, Thrive Cosmetics donates to help women thrive, i.e., women from homelessness, surviving domestic abuse, fighting cancer, and more. One of my favorite programs they work with is the Foundation for Women Warriors. It focuses on a mission for empowering women veterans re-entering civilian life. Through their partnership, Thrive Cosmetics products are available as a resource for women who are receiving supportive services. Many of these women are embarking on new careers and benefit from access to professional accessories like high-quality makeup, which can help them transition into their new role with confidence. And Thrive Cosmetics also has a variety of sets available this holiday season, which are perfect for gifting or treating yourself. Greg, did you hear that? I would like one Liquid Lash Extensions mascara. Gives me Bambi eyes. I'm almost out of my Overnight Sensation Brightening Sleep Mask. Don't you want me to be a sensation? Love their eye cream. Oh, and their Brilliant Eye Brightener. I'll put it on my Christmas list. But seriously, guys, put it on your Christmas list. Thrive Cosmetics are everything. Their products are the best I've ever used, and their Bigger Than Beauty mission is truly inspiring. You're going to love them as much as I do, trust me. Visit thrivecosmetics.com/sinners for 15% off your first order. This is an exclusive offer you can only get here. That's Thrive, T-H-R-I-V-E, Cause, C-A-U-S-E, Medics, M-E-T-I-C-S.com/sinners for 15% off your first order. thrivecosmetics.com/sinners. An autopsy was performed in Lincoln, Nebraska, and most of the details make me too sad to describe, so I'm going to give you the briefest version. The little boy had to be left to warm up in a cooler before an autopsy could be done. But after a day and a half, the boy's likeness started to emerge. He was a blonde-haired, blue-eyed boy with freckles. He had marks around his neck and head. Detectives thought he had been beaten and strangled. Because the boy didn't seem to have any dental work done, identifying him via dental records would be impossible. Detective Gary Young looked on as the doctor announced there was no damage to the skull and that the discoloration on his head could be due to the cold. Skin and bone with no fat between discolors quickly, he explained. Well, then what about the marks on his neck? The doctor then examined the child's hyoid bone in his neck, which is typically broken during strangulation, but there was no damage. He did state, however, that the bone is very flexible in children. The crime was also ruled out as being sexual in nature. No cause of death was able to be determined. Yet Detective Gary Young was certain it had to have been a homicide. So a second opinion was ordered. And a sketch artist developed a sketch of what the boy might have looked like before. According to the second doctor, he believed the boy had died from rapid freezing. According to Olson's book, the doctor to Detective Young said, quote, that in some northern states, bodies are found after people have wandered off into frozen woods by rescuers following a trail of clothing. As the victim's body temperature drops, they feel euphoric, then hot as though they are burning up. Clothing is shed in the snow. The boy could have frozen to death, but it would have had to have been rapidly. And he called the marks on the boy's neck and forehead freezer burns. It was possible, he said, that the boy was alive but unconscious when placed in the ditch. Young shook his head. None of this made any sense. There were no signs of violence on the boy's body. Judging by the condition of his body, clean and well nourished, he had to have been cared for and loved. So how had he died? If the boy had been alive, then why was he put outside in the cold? The implication of that question chilled him deeper than the blast of cold he'd felt in that field in Chester a couple weeks before. The boy had been alive when he was set outside. End quote. Gary Young was dumbfounded and distressed. Who had done this and why? The town, with similar feelings, sprung into action. The little boy couldn't be laid to rest alone, so they planned a small ceremony. But that small ceremony turned out to be hundreds upon hundreds of people coming to give love to the kid. Many traveled in from out of town, and even this will make me cry. Sorry, we had to stop because it is really sad, but keep going. So many traveled in from out of town, and some even donated all of the necessary items to make his resting place comfortable and known. A mother donated her son's size 8 suit. A widow gave up one of her family plots. And businesses donated the money for his headstone. The headstone named the boy Matthew, meaning gift of God. But they left a space below for when the boy's true identity was discovered. Residents regularly tended to his grave and left flowers and toys there. A memorial service was even held on the anniversary of the boy's discovery. Even though these people didn't know the boy, they mourned him and they loved him. John Yost had no idea when Eli showed up at his Kansas doorstep on December 15th that the boy Eli had talked so much about, little Danny, had just been dumped in a ditch hours before. Yost, not his real name, had also connected with Eli off of his ad in the Advocate magazine. This was their first meeting. And the 30-year-old school teacher was a bit taken aback by how much smaller Eli seemed in person. Perhaps the angle at which Eli had his son take butt shots of him in tight Levi's months prior were deceiving. Eli also didn't look well. His face was sunken and tired. But Yost, who was nervous about their first meeting and excited to have a companion to make the Christmas season feel less lonely, rationalized it away as he was probably exhausted from driving all night. Eli had previously told him that he was to pick up his son in Wyoming from the Barlows and then drive to Ohio to see his sick mom. I'm pretty sure in all my research, his mom wasn't actually sick. In fact, Eli never seemed to even speak to his parents since he left the Amish. But Yost asked why Danny wasn't with him, obviously unaware that the little boy was in a frozen ditch just 84 miles away, near Chester, Nebraska, and would remain there until Christmas Eve, alone. Yet Eli would spend that first day with Yost meeting his sister and parents. Could they become a couple, Yost must have thought? And Danny? Well, Eli explained away his absence, saying that he had called the Barlows before making the drive there, and Danny had presents under the tree and was having such a good time at the Barlows, he wasn't ready to leave yet. The two men had sex that first night. And I'm not trying to harp on the AIDS thing, I promise, and I was even very much in my head about how much it may have seemed like I painted all gay men as partiers, etc. That is not how I feel. This was just Eli's life. I even ran my script last week by my gay best friend and bridesman, and he said it wasn't offensive or generalizing to the gay community, but if anyone else felt that way, it wasn't my intention. I was very nervous about it. But totally not my intention. Eli is a shitty anomaly. Okay, enough of my anxiety party over here. So the two men have sex that first night. And according to Greg Olson's book, quote, Yost didn't worry about AIDS. After all, he had been negative on his AIDS test, and Stutzman had reported the same on a test he claimed he had performed in Durango. And if Stutzman hadn't wanted to use a condom, Yost could understand. He didn't want to use one either. End quote. Again, who knows when Eli contracted HIV? But what I do know is I don't believe a goddamn word he says. The next day, the two men decided to buy Christmas ornaments and decorate the tree. Yost felt a genuine bond forming, especially when Eli opened up to him about his life in the Amish, his first gay experiences, and his wife Ida. Eli didn't even criticize his Amish background. He just said it wasn't for him, for obvious reasons. Yost genuinely thought it all seemed so quaint and innocent, but then, like a record scratching, breaking the mood, Eli revealed to Yost that he had been a suspect in the murder of his roommate, Glenn Pritchard, but that his lawyer had taken care of it all and it was all in the past. He said it was probably a drug-related murder that caused the demise of his roommate and employee, but Eli had nothing to do with it. Phew, done with that little hiccup. Back to Eli being Mr. Right. Yost was falling for him, and after 5 days together, he knew he wanted to see Eli again. Meanwhile, Eli had to get to the next man to use and abuse. And Danny, poor little precious baby Danny, seemed to be the last thing on his mind. When Eli went to leave, Yost wanted to make sure Eli had a reason to come back. According to Greg Olson's book, to Yost, quote, Stutzman seemed gentle and caring. Yost did not want to lose him. I want you to leave something here so you'll have to stop by on your way back west, Yost said, as Stutzman prepared to pack for his trip to Ohio. Stutzman grinned and handed over Danny's Christmas present, a soccer ball. Until I get back, he said. Yost knew how much Stutzman's son meant to him, and there could be no doubting now that Stutzman must have felt something for John Yost. Why else would he leave the soccer ball? Yost just knew Eli Stutzman would return after Christmas. End quote. I have full body rage and sadness right now. Like, if I could go back in time to 1985 and before Eli discarded little Danny, I would find that little boy and adopt him and make him feel like the most special and loved child. Sorry, I hate Eli Stutzman. Eli then made his way to the next man, who answered one of his ads. He stayed for a few days, had joyless sex with that poor man, and then made sure that that man helped him fix his car before Eli was on his way again. Next stop, Ohio, where he stayed with old friends, a couple he knew from the Amish community. The first thing out of the husband's mouth was, "Where's Danny?" It was Christmas Eve, after all. Eli laughed and basically said, "Danny wanted to stay back in Wyoming to ski, and he'd just made good friends with the Barlows' other foster kids, and Eli just couldn't pull him away. Oh, Danny, kids are kids." The husband thought it was indeed strange, but then rationalized that Danny had been an only child, maybe he just missed hanging around other kids. Meanwhile, Danny was frozen on an embalming table in a Nebraska funeral home. The next morning, Christmas Day, while the family was opening presents, Eli said he wanted to call Danny to wish him a Merry Christmas. He went into the other room, dialed, and then came back out an hour later. He was vague with details about how Danny was, but he said he got a lot of nice things for Christmas. Who knows if he just sat in that room for an hour, talked to someone else, or for all we know, with Eli, looked at porn and jacked off for an hour. No one could hear the conversation, and they didn't want to. They thought Eli was having a nice father-son conversation with his boy. Eli had Christmas dinner with another family friend that night, made two calls to both men he had slept with on the trek to Ohio, and then returned to the former Amish couple's home. And as if the soccer ball incident, giving Danny's soccer ball gift to Yost, didn't sicken me enough, what comes next crushes me. Back at the family's home, Eli offers up that Danny has a bunch of clothes he's grown out of. Danny doesn't need these anymore. Would the couple like them for their growing boys? They didn't think anything of it, and they were grateful for the clothes, as it's hard to keep up with kids constantly growing out of them. They would remember later, though, the clothes were neat and clean, precisely folded. Not like clothes just stuffed into a bag you take to donate. Eli also gave them Danny's winter coat. And according to Olson's book, quote, "the vinyl coat was too large for their son Josh. But they didn't think anything of it. They hadn't seen Danny since they had vacationed at Stutzman's Colorado Ranch. The coat stayed in Josh's closet for a year until he had grown large enough for it to fit properly. Later, Gail Byler would be sickened when she learned that that coat had been worn by Danny the day he died." End quote. And for some reason, this next part broke my heart even more. While Danny was discarded by his father and never got to open presents that Christmas or feel the joy around the Christmas tree, share family dinner, eat Christmas cookies, wait up all night for Santa, Eli seemed more concerned with keeping up appearances and maybe being polite to this family, that on Christmas, Eli gave their children gifts. A book on horses for their daughter, which delighted the little girl because she loved horses, and a beaded Indian purse. We've shifted how we work and learn, but sometimes it feels like the world is changing faster than we can keep up with it. I mean, I personally feel like in many ways, my career and life have taken a completely different direction in the last year and a half. And it helps me to process it by talking to my trusted, licensed professional on Talkspace. I can't even begin to tell you the relief I feel after every session. Talkspace online therapy can help you manage stress, process significant life changes, and more, so you can feel less overwhelmed and more in control. And the people around us make a huge impact on our lives, and life's pressures can cause those relationships to change, for better or worse. So whether you're having complicated feelings about a relationship, or you just need a neutral person to talk to, Talkspace online therapy connects you to a licensed professional to help you work through it. And as the year ends, another holiday season is upon us. For many of us, that means travel and family, and you again, might need a neutral person to talk to. Talkspace Online Therapy has been a godsend for me. Truly, I can contact them when I want, make appointments, it's easy, contact-free. Everything about Talkspace has just soothed my soul. So, Talkspace is ready to help you start feeling better with a single message. Set goals with your Talkspace therapist and develop techniques to cope in difficult times. Talkspace offers individual therapy, couples therapy, and medication prescription services. So if you need a little support to help you through the end of the year, or you want to start building towards a better upcoming year, Talkspace is here to help. Match with a licensed therapist when you go to Talkspace.com and get $100 off your first month with the promo code SINNERS. That's $100 off when you use code SINNERS at Talkspace.com. Appearances seem to mean a lot to Eli. And Eli even went to church with the family that Sunday. To quote again from Olson's book, because he conducted these interviews and deserves the credit, quote, on Sunday, Eli went to church with the Beiler family. He seemed so much better, so much more relaxed than he had been in September. Beiler felt that whatever had been troubling him back then must be gone by now. Beiler was glad to see his friend happy, end quote. I'm sure those words were hard to hear, to write, everything, because they were extremely hard to say. He seems so much better, more relaxed. Whatever had been troubling him must be gone by now. Eli said goodbye to the family and said he was making his way back to New Mexico. He gave them money for the phone charges and bid farewell. In retrospect, the husband said he couldn't believe he hadn't noticed there wasn't one call to Wyoming. The guilt and heartbreak must have been unimaginable. But maybe not knowing saved him from what I'd like to do to Eli Stutzman, which is, at the very least, punch him in his emotionless, smug face. Moving on. January comes and goes. February arrives, and John Yost still hadn't set his eyes on Eli again like he had hoped. Wouldn't Eli have had to pass through to pick up his son? Yost was lonely and heartsick, and so he tracked down a few numbers that could have been associated with Eli. One was disconnected, and on the other, a man picked up and said Eli had moved to Texas. He gave the address to Yost, and Yost mailed Eli a Valentine. When Yost finally got a response from Eli, it was in the form of a plain white envelope with no return address. No note, just the three photographs Yost had originally mailed Eli of himself when they had connected via the Advocate ad. Eli next appeared at an old friend's house. He told the friend that he was there to pick up some stuff he had left, and he just had returned from Danny's funeral. What? Eli said this with no emotion. Yeah, he died in a terrible car accident. Apparently, he told this friend, while the Barlows were driving down the highway, a car broadsided them and, quote, Danny suffered massive head injuries. His head swelled up like a balloon. Hey, Eli, this isn't an old football injury you're describing. It's your dead child. The friend was shocked. Eli was showing no emotion. Eli did manage to also give the friend some gifts, though, to thank him for holding on to his stuff. Again, keeping up appearances. Then Eli was on his way once again. He managed to mail a letter to Danny's grandparents, the Gingriches, saying that Danny was so happy, he loved school, he was really growing up. Well, thank God the rest of the country cared about Danny. Because that same week, People magazine came out with an article about the boy with no name, Little Boy Blue. Winter of 1986 turned to summer of 86, and Eli mailed the Gingriches another letter, saying, quote, Dear folks, greetings in his name who shed his blood for us. This is Tuesday morning, 10:30 a.m. The temperature is 104 degrees already. I hope yours are all well. With some things have not been well recently. but I'm sure our good Heavenly Father knows best. He gives to be taken. I just found out this morning that the message I sent yours last week was returned instead of delivered. It was a mailagram, telegram. The post office reason was because there was no PH number included for the destination's party. Thanks for the clerical updates, Eli. Back to the letter. The sad news is about Danny. He was in a car accident near Salt Lake City on Monday of last week, July 21st, around 10 a.m. Lots of details, Eli. No one does that. And died at the hospital in Salt Lake City, Utah, on Tuesday night, 11:30 p.m., July 22nd, due to head injuries. Graveside services were held on Thursday, July 24th, for Danny in Kemmerer, Wyoming, where Danny is buried at the Barlow Family Cemetery. I'm sorry you did not get my message, but I tried. Did you? When I had the message sent, I assumed that the message would be delivered to you personally by someone from your local post office no later than Wednesday, 10 a.m., July 23rd, your time. Danny has been at this children's camp in Lyman, Wyoming since June 1st, same place as last summer, which is run by the Barlow family and was being taken to the airport by Dean Barlow to Salt Lake City, where they were hit by a semi-truck. He was going to fly here to Dallas-Fort Worth Airport, where I was going to pick him up. Were you? I received word of the accident at noon Monday, just as I was getting ready to go pick him up. So I went to Salt Lake City Monday afternoon, and I got back here yesterday. No one cares what you're doing, Eli. I'm finishing a project up here I started earlier. It will probably be here about 2 more weeks, and I will return to New Mexico. So long for now. Eli. Hey, Eli, why didn't you just sign to Opie? You're a 1950s sitcom character, apparently. So long for now. Sorry your grandchild died. Anyways, the Gingriches were beside themselves. As well they should have been. And though the Amish rarely travel by anything but buggy, they knew something was not right. Amos Gingrich told his friend of his suspicions, and they agreed to make a trip together to see said cemetery, the Barlow family cemetery that Danny was allegedly buried in. Amos, two other family members, and Yoder, his friend, made the trip. Their first stop was the police department, and they were told to wait there while the police phoned Dean and Margie Barlow. When the Barlows arrived, Amos handed Dean the letter. Dean went white. He read it and he said, "None of this is true." Margie was almost comatose. They hadn't seen Danny since Eli picked him up in December of 1985. A group of people completely in shock bonded quickly. The Barlows had the Amish group over to their house. Yet the Amish didn't think Dean was being entirely truthful. Maybe it's because Dean was in love with Eli. My thoughts, not theirs. Dean even went so far as to defend Eli a tad, saying that the Amish had really hurt him when they banned him. The Amish defended back, saying that they do that so that the person will repent. Regardless, the Amish took a train to Durango. They were trying to track Eli, but they didn't get any answers. They did not find him. With all the travel, nothing came up until months after returning home. Then the infamous Reader's Digest article comes out, and it all starts to unravel. When a little boy is missing, rules go out the window. The travel and now this phone call were the priority. Remember, the Amish are not to use the phone. Yet David Yoder, the Gingrich's friend, saw the article and called the Barlows. Margie admitted she too had read it and thought it could be Danny. She assured Yoder and sent a letter to Amos Gingrich that she was going to go to the authorities. According to Olson's book, her letter stated, quote, "Dear Amos, David Yoder called me yesterday regarding the Reader's Digest article, Little Boy Blue of Chester, Nebraska. I, too, have been haunted by the story of Little Boy Blue ever since I read it, but have been busy with the speech team in my classes, so have not acted upon it. Also, I thought maybe I was just grasping at straws and being emotional. David's call made me realize that maybe I wasn't the only one receiving gut-level feelings about the story. After David's call, Dean and I discussed the situation and decided to contact the Chester, Nebraska Police Department directly instead of going through our police department. We feel this route will bring faster answers. I'm enclosing a copy of our letter to them. I will let you know what they answer. A couple of details leave room for doubt. Unless Eli bought him one, Danny did not have a blue blanket sleeper. I'm not sure he had perfect teeth. I thought at one time I had to take him to the dentist, but may have been confused with my own children's appointments. If I'm remembering correctly, Eli left with Danny on December 20th. He should have been in Ohio by December 23rd. If he followed I-80, he wouldn't have been close to Chester, Nebraska. I checked this out with our atlas. Danny was in good health when he left, although he had a cold and the doctor had prescribed him antibiotics, which he was taking. But then, I wonder why Danny never wrote us. End quote. It's 1987 now, and Eli is still on the run. He sent letters to a few people claiming to be working with horses in England. But he wouldn't be on the run for long, because Detective Gary Young now had a name. Danny Stutzman. Could he be Little Boy Blue? Could Danny Stutzman be Little Boy Blue? And he was off to the races, never giving up on the boy. He interviewed the Amish, he pieced together the bizarre story of Eli's wife's death, and that both Glenn Pritchard and his son were dumped in ditches. Since the Amish don't take pictures, detectives needed another way to get a photo of Danny to compare with the morgue photo. They tracked down his last school photo, and the comparison was uncanny. They showed it to Margie Barlow, who further confirmed that that boy in the morgue photo had to be little Danny. On December 11th, 1987, a warrant for Eli's arrest is finally issued. But Eli is not done with his cover-ups and lies. He had made his way down to Texas. And so too did the Nebraska detectives. They tracked down a former lover of Eli's that he had stayed with for a bit. His last name was Barker. The man told them that Eli had said Danny had died in a car accident, but the details were not adding up, and he had not seen Eli in a while. He gave the detectives a list of places Eli liked to hang, a couple gay bars, etc., but no Eli. The detectives went home disappointed. After all, Eli had chosen a place in the middle of nowhere, Texas, to hide out. Azle, Texas, with a population of 10,000. I mean, enough people to not totally stand out, but more importantly, enough land to make you hard to find. But Detective Young kept in touch with the local Texas lawman, Ted Garber, who, after hearing of Eli's crimes, specifically dumping his child in a ditch during the Christmas season, also felt the nagging urge to not let this go unsolved. Eli needed to pay for his crimes. After several failed attempts to track down Eli, a stroke of luck happened. Ted Garber got a strange phone call. Around 9 p.m. on a Sunday night, someone called to tell him that Eli was using a fake name and was hiding out somewhere in the county. He gave Eli's P.O. box number, and it didn't take long for the detective to track this information to a trailer park where Eli was living. Garber drove there to take a look, and he found Eli's truck parked outside a trailer, and he instantly called for backup. At 7:45 a.m., Garber and his crew descended on the mobile home, circling it. They called Eli's roommate and let him know the house was surrounded. "Come out with your hands on your head." Would they cooperate or would they run? Eli's roommate responded that there were three men inside and they needed to get dressed first. One by one, the party-worn men filed out. Eli was number two. Garber couldn't believe how small and unimposing Eli looked, especially for a man connected to so many murders. Looks can be deceiving, though, and Garber went right for it. He showed him a warrant for his arrest for felony for child abuse. Eli immediately began denying any such thing. But Eli was arrested and was as smug as the day he was probably born. But he was smart enough to also play the naive Amish man game, too. When it came to the trial of what should have been the murder of his son Danny, Eli was well rehearsed. Meek, meager, but in my opinion, without remorse. His lawyer led him through every question as if it was a finely tuned orchestra. Eli would hold his head down and speak so softly that the judge had to ask him to speak up several times. In the end, these were the questions asked, and this was the infuriating verdict. I was unable to find the court transcript, so I'm just going to read directly from Olson's book where he obtained the script. Quote, "At some point in the trip, did you notice anything unusual about your son at any point? Or notice that he wasn't alert, or what happened, if anything?" Eli, "In the afternoon, he complained a little bit about not feeling good, and I suggested stopping, not continuing for seeing a doctor. He said he just wanted to lay down and he would be fine." Stutzman then moved some luggage and toys so that the boy could have some room to stretch out. Lawyer, "What eventually drew your attention to the back of the car?" "Well, later, late in the evening, during the night, I believe it was time for his medication. I reached back while driving and got a hold of him, and I couldn't get him awake." The lawyer looked concerned. "He didn't respond a touch?" "Right, he didn't respond. So I pulled over to see if it was about..." I was shocked to see that there was no response at all. Lawyer, "So then would you relate to the judge what, if anything, you did when you found your son didn't respond a touch?" "I was shocked. I couldn't believe finding him that way." "What did you..." Eli was told to speak up. "I tried desperately to revive him." Stutzman said that he tried mouth-to-mouth resuscitation and heart massage, but nothing worked. The boy was dead, and Stutzman didn't know what to do. He was somewhere on US 81, close to Chester, Nebraska. Oh, just 84 miles from where his next date was, where he met the guy's family after dumping his son off. Anyways, he drove to a place off the main road. He said, quote, "I had difficulty facing the fact that he had died." "But did you? But did you really? If you..." I mean, is that... Would you go to someone's house and be able to face their sister and parents and be like, "I might date this guy. I dumped my son in the..." Anyways, Eli said, "I had difficulty facing the fact that he had died. I couldn't understand, couldn't figure out why he had died or would have died under the circumstances. I pulled off the main road and made another turn or two and found a place in the valley, up in the valley, where I thought there was nobody else around. And I spent some time, quite a bit of time there, praying. And I tried again to revive him, and I just..." His lawyer cut him off. "Do you think at any time that maybe this was due to the disfavor of your God for the way you had left the church? Was that something that was bothering you?" "Bullshit." Anyways, Eli shook his head. "No, I can't tell. I don't remember that crossing my mind, that I felt guilty because of my past in any way." Stutzman thought he stayed in the valley for several hours, trying to figure out what to do with the body in the back of his gremlin. "I knew that I could go and try, you know, find a phone and get an emergency squad, but I did have feelings that maybe the facts would be against me." "What?" "The facts would be against me from my family." Stutzman's voice was soft. The lawyer again asked him to speak louder. "I thought the fact about my family might be against me, that I was not taking proper care of him. I feared for that, and I had a big difficulty realizing what had happened and why it had happened. I could not understand why it would have happened," end quote. "Okay, Eli, you can manage the inner workings of being a drug dealer, but are too meek to say your child got sick, which is not what I believe happened, but you're worldly enough for street dealing, but you can't face the Amish? Listen, if someone gave me $1 million and told me to go out and find a street drug, if that's what the kids call it, I would have no idea how to do that. What I would know how to do is say, 'Hey, 911, my son has lost consciousness,' or I don't know what happened. My son isn't breathing. And drive to the nearest hospital to get him help. But nah, Eli didn't make that a priority. And once again, he somehow charmed the courtroom. The judge sentenced Eli to 1 year for the charge of abandoning of a human body and 6 months for that of concealing a death. The counts to run concurrently. He spent almost no time for what I believe was the murder of his son. Afterward, he was charged for Glenn Pritchard's murder, and he served 13 years. In 2007, Eli was found dead in his apartment after leaving prison, with one slash to his left wrist, resulting in what was determined to be a suicide. He was alone, cocaine in his system, and well, I'm hoping at least remorseful. I never want to hear that anyone takes their own life, but this man truly seemed to only care about no one other than Eli Stutzman. That was a rough one. Sorry, guys. But thank you so much for listening. And if you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star rating and positive review on Apple Podcasts. Tell a friend. Let's be best friends. I don't know. That was too much. Thank you. Bye. Seven Deadly Sinners was created and written by me, Rachel O'Brien. Research and writing assistance by Kate Codman. Sound design and music production by Greg Hunter. And produced by Rachel O'Brien and Greg Hunter.